Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Very good. So, welcome to today's sutta class. We're going to be talking about the universally acknowledged second sutta, second discourse of the Buddha, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the discourse on non-self. And I wanted to do this fortnight because the last time I did a sutta class, I did the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, the turning of the wheel of the Dhamma, which was known as the first discourse of the Buddha. This was number two. In the first discourse of the Buddha, the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, turning the wheel of the Dhamma, there we introduce the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and with that the Middle Way, which is the Eightfold Path, and just the Buddha's exclamation of his enlightenment. And at the end of that sutra, if you remember that Venerable Kondanya, one of the Buddha's first of the five disciples, he understood exactly, you know, the fact that everything which arises passes away, can't own anything, and at that he became a stream winner, and the first stream winner in the this dispensation of the Buddha. And of course later on, still at the same location in the deer park at Sarnath outside Benares, the Buddha continued to teach his first five disciples. And apparently this particular sutta, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the characteristic of non-self, was the sutta which pushed them over the edge and made them all fully enlightened arahats. And so that this was a sutta which created the first arahats, and so it is a very powerful sutta. And it, as the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, is actually more focused on dukkha. This one is more focused on non-self, anatta. You'll know the three characteristics of existence, anicca, dukkha, anatta, and that this is all to do with anatta. The first one, dukkha. Anyone know about the anicca? Well, there's many sutras on anicca, but this one is mostly focused on non-self. And that was what pushed people over into being enlightened. And it also introduces, for the first time, a concept which must have been current before, but maybe not explained in the same way the Buddha explained it, of the five khandhas, the five groups. And those five groups, you've probably heard many times before, this is the first time it was mentioned by the Buddha, there was mentioned in the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, the five groups of the body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, which includes will and consciousnesses. But here it goes into them with a bit more detail. And as I think I mentioned the last time when I taught the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, the reason why we have these body and mind split into these five little categories is that these are places where we attach to or we think we exist. And obviously the body, and I'm still surprised these days with all the advancements in medical science, people still identify themselves with the body. And of course feelings are really important to us as we struggle and squirm when we're in pain to try and avoid the pain. When we rejoice in the pleasure and happiness of our senses, we really think that we can control those things, which is amazing after all these years. And that we believe in our perceptions, you know, how we see things, we believe is truthful. And we all know the simile of the elephant and the seven blind men. Everyone is quite clear that their perceptions are the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And the simile of the blind men and the elephant shows us that, you know, that all people, your perceptions are limited. You cannot trust them to be absolute truth. And then lastly, and then you've got the mental formations, the mental formations, which includes will. And I often said that that's one place where most people think they exist. They think they own their will is part of them, and their will is their friend. And the last one is the consciousnesses, and not just one consciousness, but six different types. So that's where we first introduce the five khandhas as well. And this is using the five khandhas to have a very strong argument for the fact there cannot be anybody in here. So here we go. The characteristics of non-self, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Varanasi, that's Benares, in a deer park at Isipatana. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus of the group of five, thus, bhikkhus. Venerable Sir, those bhikkhus replied, the Blessed One said this, bhikkhus, form, this rupa, is non-self. For, if monks, form were a self, then this form would not lead to affliction, and it would be possible to have it of form. Let my form be thus, let my form not be thus. But because form is non-self, that's why this form leads to affliction, and it's not possible to have it of form. Let my form be thus, let my form not be thus. So the form in this particular case, it would have been better to translate it as body, because that's basically what it means. Although you can extend that to other parts, you know, of the physical world. But in particular, it's about your own body. So you say, body is not me, it's not myself. If it was me, I could say of my body, well, number one, it wouldn't lead to affliction. If it was mine, I could control it. That's the whole idea of ownership. You can control these things. And as Jacob was saying earlier, yeah, you know, his car, actually, he doesn't have a car anymore, but he used to have a car. He said, yeah, you know, the car, I own my car, and I know that sometimes it doesn't work. It doesn't prove that I don't own it, but at least you can do a lot of stuff with your car. You know, you can actually make it work sometimes, but sometimes this body of ours, you know, it does lead to affliction. I was going to say, because I'm a cheeky monk, that imagine that, you know, say your wife, you know, your wife is not yours. Because if she were yours, you had full control over her, she would not lead to affliction. And you'd be able to say, oh, may my wife be like this, oh, may my wife be like that. Okay, now you can change that to husband if you know you're women. You can't control them, can you? And it's the same with your body. Your body is, you know, just like your partner. You know, you try to control it, but you just can't do it. Now, the whole point of this is that, you know, if it really was not a self here, it really was your essence, who you were, then, of course, you know, you'd expect, you know, that if it was your essence, it wouldn't be an affliction. The whole idea of, even in Christianity, of a soul, an essential being, you know, and in Hinduism, an Atman or a power Atman, you know, it can't be, it just goes against the whole idea that a soul can be affliction and suffering. Otherwise, you know, it means, say if the soul was inherently afflicted, it means when people go to heaven, it wouldn't be really worth the name heaven. It would be just suffering, suffering, suffering. There'd be affliction all the time, suffering all the time. It is sort of understood in the idea, you know, of the characteristic of a soul, an essence, who you really are underneath everything else. That when you peel off all of the outer layers, the inner layer, the essence, the thing you really should be, has to be pure, has to be pretty constant, and has to be not suffering. So her soul has to be eternal, has to be happy. Otherwise, it doesn't really make much sense. Ask any sort of Hindu scholar, or Christian scholar, or Jewish scholar, and they would sort of say, yes, the soul, if it's embodied in a body, or if it's, you know, living in a world, yeah, it experiences pain and suffering, but the essence, the inside, the one which is the real pure thing, that is happy. And so the idea of a soul being unhappy, even just, you know, not always unhappy, but sometimes unhappy, sometimes happy, that's not pure enough, that's not high enough to really fulfill the categorizations of this word, a soul, a self here. So when there is, you know, some suffering there, and also some idea that, you know, these things happen without you, no matter how much you practice, how much you actually practice yoga, eat brown rice and organic food, still the body suffers. You can't control it. Yeah, you can nudge it, but you can't control it. And so he was saying, look at your bodies, monks. Sometimes you say this, may my body be like this, may not be like that. You know, when you do get sick, sometimes sickness comes at the most inappropriate times. You know, when you really, it's really inconvenient. I've got something to do. I've got to go traveling somewhere. And unfortunately, your body doesn't follow the agenda you have planned in your diaries. When it gets sick, it just gets sick, and you can't do much about it. So, you cannot control the body. And because of that, they're saying, this is the reason why. You can't have it like this. May my body be thus, may my body not be thus. A lot of people do fight old age. A lot of people do fight sickness. And even I was at the Cancer Wellness Association just last Thursday. It was Cancer Day last Thursday. And even there, I have a wonderful discussion with one of the leaders over there who was asking me, he said, is it right to say you should fight cancer? And I was telling him, no, don't fight cancer. That's going to make it worse. And he smiled, and he's a president of the Cancer Wellness Association. He said, thank you so much. I've been trying to tell this to people for a long time. It makes things worse. And one of the reasons is because you're trying to say, oh, may my body be like this, may my body be like that. You can't control it. It's not your body. What you can do is other strategies, but not controlling. So if you have it like this, oh, may my body not be this, may not have the cancer, may not have the old age, let my body be something else. You're actually wasting a lot of time there. The body is out of control. I always say it belongs to nature. It doesn't belong to you. You can work with nature to keep the body reasonably healthy, but only up to a point. But it doesn't follow your instructions. And now we go to the other of the five khandhas. First of all, feeling, vedana. And of course, as I always mention when I talk about the five khandhas, there is no sufficient, accurate English word for the Pali word vedana. They call it here feeling, but what it truly means is that quality of pleasure or suffering which is with every one of the six senses. And we always give it a different word for every sense. So the pleasure involved with the eye is called beauty. You know, the pleasure involved with, say, smelling something is fragrant. And the suffering involved with those two senses, and it's ugly and stinky for smell. So we always have different words, you know, for the different vedana of our six senses. But whatever you are experiencing through any one of the six senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching, and knowing, it's either pleasurable, or it is suffering, or it is somewhere in between. But it always has that affective quality, as they say. The quality of you like it, you don't like it, or it's okay, it's in the middle somewhere. And that is such an important part of Buddhism, and actually of life. It's really quite strange that there's no real adequate word in English for this, because it is misunderstanding that pleasure and the pain which drives our craving, always seeking just relief from suffering, from ugliness, from bad sounds, bad smells, always running away from those and seeking the pleasurable part of our senses. And what the Buddha says here, that even your vedana is non-self. For if, monks, vedana were self, this vedana would not lead to affliction. It would be possible to have it of vedana, let my vedana be thus, let my vedana not be thus. But because vedana is non-self, vedana leads to affliction. It is not possible to have it of your vedana, let my vedana be this, may it not be like this. You cannot control suffering and pleasure. You spend all your life trying to do that, trying to escape from pain, trying to have happiness and pleasure. But you know, a lot of times you just find as much happiness and pleasure whether you're fighting and trying to control or you don't. In fact, you usually find more happiness and pleasure. With all of the great advances of medicine, modern technology, and being able to have entertainment at our fingertips. You know, what a sultan you know, 100, 200 years ago, what a great king 300 years ago would do for pleasure. We can actually see that on our TVs, even on our laptops, even on your smartphones, whatever you want, whenever you want it. You have a whole list of music and just these incredibly wealthy people. You know, they would, you know, have to pay a lot of money and wait a long time for even just one of those songs, which you have available 24 hours a day, whenever you want. So with all of that sensory pleasure available to us, are we happy? Are we happier than people 50 years ago, 60, 70, 80 years ago? There's a few of you can answer that question because you're nodding your head. So we spent all this time trying to control our happiness, avoid suffering, but have we really succeeded? Or is it just pretty much the same? That's what the Buddha is saying here. You're Vedana. It's not possible to have it. Oh, let my life have more pleasure and less suffering. And so trying to have all these different techniques, skillful means, technology, abilities to fly wherever we want, whenever we want. We still can't have it. So it's interesting to understand the nature of the pleasure and pain of life. We try to control it, but the Buddha here is telling us, you can't. You can again nudge it, but you can't control it. And that's such a powerful insight to know that you're a human being, you're going to suffer. And it's not your fault. And it's not your husband's fault either. It's not your monk's fault for telling bad jokes. It's just life. You can't do much about it. So it means it's out of your control. So stop trying to control your happiness and suffering. In other words, stop craving. And the next one is this perception. Perception, monks, is non-self. If perception were self, then this perception would not lead to affliction. How does your perception lead to afflictions? How many times do you see it the wrong way and make a mistake and get into big trouble because you do perceive things, you know, in the wrong way? A lot of times all your perceptions, you know, how you learn to see things is conditioned into it. You can see how it happens at school. They give these little pictures, mummy, daddy, you know, baby. For a long time my perception was baby girls wear pink, baby boys wear blue. Unfortunately, no one told me about this, they've changed. And so about a year or 2 years ago, somebody wanted a baby blessing. And so, oh, he's such a cute kid. And so sort of I picked him up to do the hair cutting. Said, no, it's not a kid, it's a girl. It's not a boy, it's a girl. But why do you put blue on him? So a lot of times these little things which we learn, that this is a girl, this is a boy, you know, because of, you know, hairstyle, some of you don't know who's who. So because of that, sometimes our perceptions are unreliable. And they lead to affliction because sometimes we perceive things in a way which are not very helpful. Sometimes you perceive things with fear, when they're not really fearful. Why are you afraid of these things? Sometimes ghosts, or sometimes in meditation, you know, let's take ghosts for example. Why are Asians so afraid of ghosts? I always thought the ghosts were really interesting. That's how I was trained. Or when I was in Thailand, the lizards, the geckos in lizard, the lizards over there, they were really beautiful. And all the Westerners who were in Thailand, when we saw those lizards, we thought they were lovely creatures. But for Thais, they were disgusting. They hated those. And for us, for me, the spiders, they're going to bite you. They're going to do things to you. And I was always scared of spiders. And the local Thais, what are you talking about? Spiders don't bite anybody. No, they just stay in the corner, eat the insects. They're good. So perceptions were totally opposite. We'd love the geckos, and the Thai monks would chase them out as soon as they could. They hated them. And the monks, the Western monks, would actually chase the spiders out. And so the Western monks would chase the spiders out, and the Thai monks couldn't understand, what are you doing? Perceptions were totally different. So, you know, where did they come from? You could see where they come from. Most of our perceptions come from our culture. There's so many ghost movies in Chinese culture, Thai culture. That's why people are afraid of them. It's just conditioning, that's all. So the perceptions, where they come from, you can't control them. A lot of them are just embedded in you by this time. And it would be wonderful to say, oh, let my perception be thus, let my perception not be thus. But because perception is not under your control, it's conditioned from outside of you by your culture. That's why perception leads to afflictions. It's not possible to have it of perception, let my perception be thus, let my perception not be thus. And then we've got the big one, two big ones, sankhara. And also, sankhara also means thinking, as well as will. And now we're going to say thinking. Now, this is a wonderful little teaching for those of you who meditate and have trouble freeing your mind of thoughts. So let's just say, bhikkhus, thought is not self. For if monks' form were self, so if monks' thoughts were self, these thoughts would not lead to affliction. It would be possible to have it of thoughts. Let my thoughts be this, like this. Let my thoughts not be like that. But because your thoughts are not yours, non-self, that's why your thoughts lead to affliction. And it is not possible to have it of thoughts. Let my thoughts be thus. Let my thoughts not be thus. How many times do you try and control your thoughts? And that's what the Buddha is saying here. You can't control them. They're not yours. Where do thoughts come from? In meditation, we're asked to look at thoughts just like clouds in the sky. You know, I look at the clouds in the sky, they're not mine. You know, no matter how many powers you have, you can't control them. Sometimes you look there as a monk after deep meditation and you say, okay, cloud, you move over here. This one, move over there. It doesn't do it. Or you can try and say, especially if you've got some, say, rain clouds. Sometimes, you know, really like more rain in the forest. You see a rain cloud and it's missing our monastery. You say, come, 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 come. It doesn't do it. That's with clouds in the sky. And that's a similar we use for your thoughts in meditation. They're not yours. Nothing to do with you. So you just look at them as clouds, which means you don't get involved in them. You don't sort of try and stop them. You don't worry about them. You don't get involved in them. They are just thoughts. In meditation, it's just like the movie. The movie on the screen, which I've said to Simri quite a few times. The only reason why you get excited with a movie is when you get literally sucked into the movie screen, which is why that when there's something exciting happening in a movie screen, your heart starts pumping. It's only a movie. It's usually a rerun. Anyone who's gonna get killed, they will get reincarnated in the next showing of the movie. In Titanic, apparently there's some very sad love affair where when the ship sinks, these two lovers, they go down with the ship. They don't really go down with the ship. Because apparently I've seen in the newspapers, as Leonardo DiCaprio, he's still alive, he didn't die. It's only a movie. But it's amazing when we're watching a movie, especially if it's an exciting movie, a frightening movie, or a romantic movie. How many times do we really get caught up in that? We get emotionally involved. We're actually on the ship when it goes down, literally. And in a football match or a cricket match, we're actually on the field. That's why I keep noticing that people shout, kick the ball, shoot, offside referee. And they're watching a match which is being rerun, which was played in England about 2 days ago. It doesn't matter how loud you shout, they cannot hear you. But why do we do that? Sorry? Yeah. It makes you feel good, but how stupid are you? The Asian Cup, shoot, shoot. And that was being held over in the East somewhere. And doesn't matter how... you're not really strong enough to shout so they can hear you in Sydney from Perth. But we do that because we get sucked up. That's exactly the same with thinking. If we can just look at them as just clouds in the sky, they're out of control, they're not ours. So all the shouting, all the screaming, all the tears, all the jumping up and down, you realize what a waste of time that all is. It's not mine, you can't control it. Oh, let it be like this, let it be like that. You can't. That means you let it go. That's what it means here. The thoughts are non-self. Nothing to do with me. They're just thoughts, that's all. And a lot of people have the understanding, I mean, we don't do anything about them, they'll keep going on forever and ever and ever. And so you get involved, and what happens? They go on forever and ever and ever. So it's dead. You just realize, nothing to do with me, none of my business. Okay, thoughts. Then they disappear. When you don't get involved, you don't invest energy in them. That's where they disappear. You had a question there? Okay.
And then I've also heard about books that the
Hindu gurus can organize
weather.
Okay, so you are saying there are some shamans or Hindu gurus who can actually bring in the clouds and organize the weather.
Yeah, I've actually experienced
Could
that.
You please give them a call, SMS them, and make it cooler today? It's too hot today. There's a little bit of nudging. I agree that sometimes some little nudging can be done, but not much at all. They cannot really control the weather, because otherwise, can't they all come together and stop global warming? Can't they actually just get some rain to the areas where there's big bushfires? You know, if they have the power, then they're not using it compassionately. Instead of just showing off to people, do it some use of it. Land cleansing, but if they have any power to affect the weather, there's much more things you could do, much better things. There's many farmers who go bankrupt and their kids, you know, can't go to school. They're hungry because of floods or because of droughts, fires. So we can't really do that cleansing. Tiny bit, just a little bit of showing off, but the real stuff we can't do. Same with your thoughts. You can do a little bit with your thoughts, but not that much. As much as with the weather. We just have to learn how to realize this weather is not ours. You can nudge it a little bit. But the Buddha is saying it's not yours. Yes. So if it's not yours, what happens? You stop complaining when it's a hot day. What do you expect? It's February. In Australia, it's hot. People complain. I always used to complain in England. Oh, it's really bloody cold today. What do you expect? It's London. It's December, January. What do you expect, for goodness sake? So a lot of times you can see just how, when we don't understand things, we think that these things are ours. That's why we cause trouble. And you spend all your life trying to control the weather. All your life in meditation trying to control your thoughts instead of just letting them go. And the big one, obviously, is will. That's also part of mental formation, sankhara, the fourth kanda. So, monks, and I love, this is where, you know, I kept reading this to myself. You know, let the Buddha bang, bang, bang. Come on, be sensible, Ajahn Brahm. Will is non-self. That's the fourth kanda, where it says over here, mental formations, or volitional formations. Will is non-self. For monks, if will were self, your will would not lead to affliction. Straight away. The whole purpose of a will, you know, is try and avoid affliction. You know, so you can avoid falling into the potholes of life. So you can avoid, you know, all the suffering and stuff. But look at your, have you succeeded yet with your will? Does it really fulfill its promises? You work really hard. You really get your will and just apply yourself to your education. So what? Does that really sort of give you the happiness? Sometimes you apply your control to actually to get what you want, however you want it. But does that really work? Sometimes the obstacles come in your way and the will doesn't work. Or sometimes it's stupid. You know what Buddha is saying here, that will leads to affliction. And it's not yours. And when I kept reading that, what do you mean will is not mine? I can decide what I will and what I don't will. And the Buddha was saying, no way. And that just started to really make me, what is this will anyway? Where does it come from? And you've heard me say before that your will does not come from you. It's not yours. It's not a self. It's not a byproduct of yourself. It's not made by yourself. It doesn't originate from yourself. And I think you should all know this by now. Just you look at why, whenever I have a choice, whenever I decide to do something, why? Where did that will come from? And I can trace it back. Conditioning. I was taught to do this. I was trained to do this. And it appears to be my will, but it ain't. And that wonderful experience, which I like talking about, being in the Cambridge Psychic Research Society. And actually one of my friends, hopefully, you know, he's umming and ahhing. He said he's going to accept to come to the conference, but he is, I think, finally going to accept. And he was in the Cambridge, he was also a physicist. He was in the Cambridge Society for Psychic Research. And every year we used to get the hypnotist to come and, you know, give us a demonstration. It was always a full house that night because the hypnotists, you know, do really funny things. And I know I tried. As a student, you know, you're willing to humiliate yourself in front of your friends because that's like being a student in those days. So you get up there and they try and hypnotize you. I was not a good subject, so I went back to my seat. But there's always a few of your friends were good subjects. And then they make them do stupid things. This is undergraduates. Take down your trousers or something. Moon everybody or whatever. You know, for students, that was hilarious. But then they would always get this one guy who was really, really into deep hypnosis. And I remember that they asked him to sing the British National Anthem in full voice. Not now, but when the hypnotist, after he took him out of meditation, touched his right earlobe. And that was the instruction. We'd all see this. You'd take him out of his hypnosis and you'd go and sit down. And of course, you know, you didn't need to tell all the students, keep quiet, don't tell this guy what's up. Because, you know, we had no compassion for this guy at all. We just wanted to see him make a fool of himself as being a student. And sooner or later, the hypnotist would touch his ear. He was a great entertainer. He would actually go close and then touch somewhere else, you know, just to make us excited. And then eventually he'd touch his ear. And it was the most hilarious memory of that time. This student would stand up in a loud voice, sing the British National Anthem. And even though he had about 100, 150 students in there laughing their heads off, you know, howling, and that he wouldn't stop. He would actually go right to the very end of it and then stop and sit down. And when we had all finished laughing, he wasn't embarrassed at all. He just sat down. He just did what he needed to do. And after we all settled down, that's when the hypnotist interrogated this boy. Why'd you do that for? And when we were listening, that would send shivers down my spine. Because it was very obvious that that young man had a cogent reason for singing. To him, it appeared he'd sung that song totally from his free will. And he couldn't. No one could convince him otherwise. So you were hypnotized. No, I wasn't. I had a reason for doing this. I saw my will come up and I decided, yeah, it's a good thing to sing it now. Even the most ridiculous thing you can do, and you think you decided to do it. So sometimes you wonder, Barbara, why did you marry your husband? It seemed like a good idea at the time. Sometimes you wonder, what did I do that for? But what that really starts to really cut deep inside of you, because this will you assume is comes from you, that it looks like that, it feels like that, it smells like that, I would have said, no, you're being fooled. Well, it's not yours. And you try and control your will. Oh, my will be like this. Maybe smart. May I not make mistakes? May I not say stupid things? You try your whole life to do that. Impossible. So you realize your will leads to afflictions. You make bad choices. Would it be a positive habit of will? Oh, let my will be like this. Let my will not be like that. But because the will is not yours, will leads to affliction. And it's not possible to have it of your will. Let my will be like this, let my will not be like this. And the last one, the another big one, consciousness. And as you have heard from me, the right translation there is add an ES on the end, consciousnesses. Because there's six different types of consciousness. When you only have a single there, consciousness, you think, okay, yeah, this is mine, this is self, and I am the consciousness. But when you actually see it as six different types of consciousnesses, because seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and knowing are totally different. And you don't have two at the same time. Just one and then another one, then one and then another one. So this is actually the nature of consciousness. But you see, it says here, consciousness is not self. It's not a soul, not my essence. Because, monks, if consciousness were a self, this consciousness would not lead to affliction. What do you mean consciousness lead to affliction? Can't I just, whenever I see suffering, just close my eyes to it? When I hear bad sounds, just not hear them? Can just not know any bad thoughts or any bad mind states? Can I actually control my consciousness so it only receives nice stuff? You can't do that. That's why it leads to affliction. And it's not possible to have it of consciousnesses. Let my consciousness be like this, let my consciousness be like that. That's like the first argument, which starts, the first argument here starts to really undermine the identification of any of these things as yours, as yourself, and most importantly, as any of your business. Things which you're supposed to control and make better and improve. All of these five things, Buddha's saying, it's none of your business. It's like somebody else's business. It's nature's business. Any questions on that so far? Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. But I mean, like, really improved. Just, it's just like your apartment. You can just paint it, but even if it's old and falling down, there's nothing much you can do to it. Just like your husband, you can give him a bypass, but it's still the same old husband when he comes out of hospital. It's not that new, is it? You could have asked him, "Can you do a few more things there while he's inside?" You can't do that. That's what you mean. You sort of. Paint it up a bit, but you can't really improve it. Yeah. Indeed, you're saying that. Now, well, what does affect these things? If it's not sort of me, who's actually controlling all of this? Why does my mind go this way and that way? And instead of calling it karma, which is quite narrow, call it conditioning. And karma is one of those conditionings. The other conditionings is your environment, your teaching, your training, where you come, what happened to you today. That always sort of makes who you are, or who you think you are. So this is a whole heap of conditioning comes together, and here I am, or this body mind. Karma is only one of those. Yeah. Yeah, it just basically disappears, yes. So it's just like, You know, many of you have experienced in meditation. You know, you settle your body down, you can only go so far in relaxing it, and then after a while you don't bother anymore. We don't bother with the body, it vanishes. You can't feel it anymore. The body is still there. You know, it's not vanished. People can take a photograph of you when you're meditating, you're still there. But, you know, you're just not concerned with it, then it disappears. Just like your thoughts, they disappear because, you know, you're not bothered with them. Yeah, the last thought, you know, gives a lot of conditioning to the next thought. But it's not just your thoughts, it's what you're listening to. I am now conditioning many of your thoughts. So it's also the weather as well, your health. You know, as a doctor, sometimes, you know, if you're very, very sick and tired, you get certain types of thoughts which are like sick and tired thoughts. You know, when you're sort of, you're falling in love, you have lovey-dovey thoughts. And sometimes, you know, the body can influence, you know, the way we think. It's not me, you know, it's the PMS. It's the... And it's the sickness talking. Often I tell people that, you know, it's the anger talking, it's not the person, or the sickness is grouching, not the person. Okay, so we go to the next part of this sutra, where the Buddha's doing a Q&A with his disciples. What do you think, monks, is body, instead of form, is body permanent or impermanent? Of course it's impermanent, it's always changing, getting old. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, Venerable Sir, and I point there because when I first saw that, I said, well, why? Sometimes I remember hearing variety is the spice of life. When things change, that can be happiness. But then if you look at it in a bit more detail, the stability is what a lot of people aim for, as you know, an ultimate type of happiness. You know, like a stable relationship, stable finances, stable politics, just so we know where we are in life. And we always, you know, tend to find a place where we can retire, take it easy so we don't have to change things anymore. A lot of times change is very threatening. It is suffering. So that's why he's saying that because form is impermanent, it is going to be suffering, even if, as one person once imagine if life went backwards. And if life went backwards and we were born an old man, an old woman. So, you know, we're born just with grey hair and no teeth. And then every day we get younger. So, you know, we get rid of old age in the early part of our life. We have something to look forward to, you know. to our middle age and being wealthy. And then as we, every day we get poorer because, you know, when you're sort of young you don't have as much money, but you get fitter and healthier. And then when you know more about life, you can have, you know, young people the best sex because, you know, you've got more wisdom now. That'd be really good. And then you can look forward to going to school. And in school you don't learn more and more, you learn less and less. And eventually the last few years of your life you spend just like playing around all day, having no responsibilities. And last of all, just, you know, on your mother's breast, just having nothing to do all life. And you end this world as a glint in your mum and dad's eye. That's what they say. It's an interesting way, just life being lived backwards. It was. Oh, really? Okay. That's where I got it from. Okay. Yeah, but would that be happiness? Because there'd still be suffering, because anything which is changing, you'd always have the best part, and you want to stay at the peak. And even if, you know, you get to a peak and there's another peak higher, it means the peak you're at now is suffering. And of course, as soon as you get to a peak, because it changes, you have to go down again. So that is why this is suffering. Whatever is permanent, whatever is changing, if you contemplate it, it has to be suffering. Is what is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this is my, this is myself. Anything which is impermanent and suffering, subject to change. First of all, the idea of it being a self, a soul, it doesn't really fit. Because the whole idea, the definition, if you like, of the word self or soul is the permanent, unchanging essence of a person. You know, it's things which don't change. If it's changing, there must be something inside, you know, which sometimes changes. But the inside, the eternal, the essence, has to be permanent, unchanging. And certainly cannot be suffering. And is this regarded as me, mine, or a self? No, venerable sir. And then is Vedana permanent or impermanent? And we all know that you can't have permanent happiness or permanent suffering. We know we can't have permanent happiness because it's always changing. That's one of the reasons why the whole idea of a heaven where you can live happily ever after never made any sense to me. You know, imagine, just I always imagine, the Christian heaven of having the same old harp music day in, day out. Ambrosia. Ambrosia is maybe really nice when you first have it. But, you know, if you have that after a couple of hundred years, anything but ambrosia, please. So you can understand that just, you know, you can't have permanent pleasure. And I also remember reading in some, I think it's theology tract, there's some Christian theologian, quite sharply, wisely, said that in heaven, you know, for one day a year, everyone in heaven is sent to hell for one day, so they can appreciate what heaven is. Otherwise, they would not really have any understanding of happiness. It would be taken for granted, it would be normal. So, you know, even in heaven, they said, one day a year, you have to go to hell. Yeah. Reminds you, yes. Things are impermanent, which is one of the reasons why that we understand that when things... Yeah, indeed, yeah. That's exactly right. That's why I travel around so much, make sure I'm not always here. So you appreciate me more. Well, that's very true. So, Vedana is impermanent. Perception, well, this is more interesting. Perception is an impermanent or permanent, your perceptions. Are you right? Or sometimes afterwards you realize, yeah, I was right at the time, but now I realize I was wrong. Your perceptions are not constant, so you can't trust them. They may appear so accurate and so right today. And how many of you have said things and thought things, oh God, that was a stupid thing I thought. I got it totally wrong. Perceptions are impermanent. It's what is impermanent, suffering or happiness. It is suffering. It's what is impermanent, suffering and subject to change, fit to be regarded thus. This is mine, this I am, this is myself, it's my perception. No, venerable sir. And again, the big ones are thoughts, permanent or impermanent. And it's impermanent, venerable sir. It's what is impermanent, suffering or happiness? Suffering, venerable sir. Yes, thoughts are suffering. And what do you mean thoughts are suffering? Maybe your thoughts, Ajahn Brahm, I have nice thoughts. I can think of beautiful scenarios, wonderful fantasies, where I'm the hero, where I score the winning goal for Australia in the Asian Cup, and everyone's cheering for me. My thoughts are happy thoughts. Have you ever noticed, because you can't control your thoughts, you may have a wonderful thought one day and then you really go into the dumps and have negative thoughts all day. Your thoughts are impermanent. They're suffering. They're subject to change. There's one impermanent suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus. This is mine. My thoughts. Who said they're my thoughts? It's wonderful when you have a thought and it's not my thought. The Buddha said so. Okay, it's not my thought. Oh, what a relief. I don't have to be responsible for my thoughts anymore. I can just let them go. They are none of my business. My business. They're not my thoughts. Just like, you know, you get... sickness in the body. You get heat, you get tummy ache. It's not my tummy ache, it's just the body doing its thing. Just that's thoughts, that's all. Just part of having a mind, but not mine. So I don't worry about them. So, no, they're not mine. So there's a regard, this is mine, this I am, this is myself. The thinking. That's Descartes. I think, therefore I am. And the Buddha said, no way. Because you think, it doesn't mean you are. Because your thoughts change, because you can't control them. That shows you are not. Your thoughts. Now, will. This is all part of the volitional formations, what they say here. Is your will permanent or impermanent? It is impermanent. We all know that. Will comes and goes. Is what is impermanent, suffering or happiness? Suffering, Venerable Sir. And for me, again, that was a big one. Will is suffering? No, will is actually good. It's my friend. You know, my will made me become a monk. Well done, Will. Good on you. That's a good choice I made. But the will never lets you alone. It sometimes makes some good choices. But then you start thinking, like many young monks, well, maybe should I disrobe? Or maybe should I get married? Maybe I will do this, and then I will do that, and I will do that. And you're supposed to be meditating and being quiet. Will does not leave you alone. You think it's yours, but a lot of times it just torments you. Sorry? Will. No, a thought doesn't have as much power. You may think to go and sort of kill, you know, Tony Abbott, but that won't do very much. But when you will yourself to do it, then that's a bit more dangerous. So will is much more powerful. So, but we always think it's under our control, and we also think that it's my will. And we have such a strong identification with will. That's why when somebody tries to control us, we resist it. You know, we have what's the United States Declaration of Independence. It was like an independence of will, the land of the free. So you can choose what you want to do, and you have complete freedom for the pursuit of happiness. Trying to make sure that you don't have your will controlled by government or any other agencies. And that's the biggest lie in the Constitution. Is it Fifth Avenue or something, where all the big advertisement agencies are located? That is where Mara lives. Fifth Avenue, New York. Controlling all the world through advertising. It controls your will. You know, the spin. So Mara lives. And they make much more than they spend. Yeah. I remember looking at some science review and they said, just it's been well proven year after year after year, study after study, that for every dollar you spend on advertising, on average, you make $3 back. One of the best investments, you know, in business, let alone in politics. How much money do politicians spend on elections? Why do they do that? Because it works. And many of you look at the advertisement. It's a stupid advertisement. Who would believe in that? You're no different than everybody else. It works. You do believe. Smartphones. Why do you buy those things? Advertisement, that's all. It's not smart, you're dumb. Sorry? Yes, indeed. Every second. Yeah, very good. So that's, you're smart, yeah. That's Will. And lastly, consciousnesses. Are consciousnesses permanent or impermanent? Impermanent. Your consciousness is always changing. That's why, especially when you have six consciousnesses, they're always flipping from one to another. So, is what is impermanent, suffering or happiness? Suffering. To be conscious is to suffer. What do you mean? Yeah, that's really ridiculous. Consciousness is being alive. It's being here. Come on, get your act together, Ajahn Brahm. Be happy. But consciousness is suffering. And you really realize that when you go into meditation, when your consciousnesses start to disappear. I told you that, you know, when your five sense consciousnesses, five out of six have gone, you're blissed out. You know, the ecstasy of jhanas. And you ask, why? Why is that one of the most, like, the happiest state you can get outside of other jhanas? By far. Remember I told you there was one guy coming to visit Bodhinana Monastery, heroin addict, unfortunately. And he was really trying his best to get off the heroin addiction. And, you know, he's doing some meditation. And one day he came running after me. I was about to come here on a Friday to go into Anolamara here, this place, for the weekend. And running after me, he said, look, before you go, I have to tell you this. You know, you've always been telling me, Ajahn Brahm, that these jhanas are bliss better than sex. I thought, yeah, maybe, but I never thought they were bliss better than heroin. And they are. He got a really good meditation. Unfortunately, he regressed afterwards and got back into heroin. Just that really sort of so sad. But anyway, he had one good experience. He said, and as a heroin addict, one of the reasons why they're an addict is because the bliss, the ecstasy of taking the heroin is much, much, much better than sex. That's why you get addicted to it, the happiness level. And he knew what he was talking about. But then he said, I never thought I'd say that the meditation is far happier than heroin. So we're going to some pretty, pretty high states here. He would have seen impermanent. Yeah. Yeah. Heroin, yeah, because heroin is impermanent too. It is. But the main point I was making here is just, why are those jhanas so happy? It must be because the five senses have gone. And you realize the five consciousnesses are suffering. And that's exactly, to realize that is very helpful for people, because, you know, when you die, that's what happens. Five of your consciousnesses are turned off. And you're happy. People with near-death experiences, nearly all, sort of say, what a beautiful, happy experience that is. Consciousness is suffering. And then you start consciousness vanishing in the deeper jhanas, happier and happier. You realize consciousness is suffering. Now that is such a controversial, confronting thing to say. But it's true. This is what the Buddha's saying over here. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yes. Yes. Indeed. Very good. Because indeed, all the consciousness is suffering. So what's the escape? Shut them all down. But anyway, we'll maybe get onto that in the very end. So, here we go. That's with the consciousness. It's not fit to be regarded thus. This is mine. My consciousness. This I am. This is myself. Mine consciousness. This is the real me. No, venerable sir. And this is, the Buddha really pushes it totally to make sure there's no loopholes. Therefore, monks, any kind of form, body whatsoever, whether past, future or present, internal in your bodies or other people's bodies, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all bodies should be seen as they really are with correct wisdom. This is not mine. This I am not, this is not myself. You know, even sort of like deva bodies, no, heavenly bodies, all bodies should be seen, not me, not mine, not a self. All feeling whatsoever, whether past, future or present, mine or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all those Vedanas should be seen as it really is, with correct wisdom. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Even the most beautiful pleasure you've ever had in your life. The time when you feel like unified with the whole universe. This pleasure must be the real me. Because people sometimes get sucked into that. Either a near-death experience or in the deep jhanas, it's so pleasurable. We think this must be the real me. This is who I really am. And as you mentioned, it ends. It can't be you. But you see that all of that is not yours. It changes. It can't be. All perceptions whatsoever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all perceptions should be seen as it really is with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Just perceptions, that's all. All thought. I'm just splitting the mental formations, volitional formations into two. All thought whatsoever, whether past, future, or present, all your old thoughts, your new ones, and ones in the future, all thoughts, internal, others, the gross or the subtle thoughts, the really amazing, beautiful thoughts of understanding, enlightenment, or inferior or inferior, inferior or superior, far or near, all thoughts should be seen as they really are with correct wisdom. This is not mine. This is not. This I am not. This is not myself. Will? Whatsoever. Past, future, or present, internal or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all will should be seen as it really is with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. All consciousnesses, I love this one, whether past, future, or present, internal or other people's consciousnesses, gross or subtle, inferior or cosmic, instead of superior, cosmic consciousness, unifying consciousness, the ground of all consciousnesses. Because this is where a lot of people think the ultimate reality lies. Original consciousness, original mind, whatever. And the Buddha says all consciousnesses, including all mind consciousness, is the sixth consciousness. All, without exception, should be seen as it really is with the correct wisdom. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. And that was the final argument. Seeing thus, monks, the instructed noble disciple experiences revulsion towards form. Revulsion, that was my suggestion to Bhikkhu Bodhi, somewhere between just the idea of turning away. Sometimes we're looking for a good world. Repulsion was a bit too negative. Just you want something which was going to push you away. I call this revulsion, nibbida in Pali, as samsara's ejection seat. You're on the wheel of samsara, and when you press the nibbida button, it throws you off. And if you don't do anything, you just let things be. You're not really attached, but you're still on the wheel. So this is actually what happens. You think, crikey, what do I want to do this for? What do I want another body for? What do I want this body for? What do I want? More feelings, more pleasure. And I'm just going to get more pain. It's just more of the same. No more perceptions. More thoughts. Have you had enough thoughts yet? But I want the beautiful thoughts, the refined thoughts, the thoughts of enlightenment, the thoughts of all thoughts. You get revolted by them. Because revulsion comes from being revolted. Well, it is, yeah. So, and all will, you feel revulsion towards will. You just cause me so much restlessness. You promised so much, my will. You've only delivered me just more being unsettled, more agitation, just more things I shall have to do. So I'm revolted by you, will. And all my consciousnesses, you get revolted by them. In other words, you just turn away. Yes. Yes. Very good. Very good. Yeah, you're just saying, that's a really good question. You're saying for a long time you think that these are things you have to attain, you have to get enlightened, and and just reach enlightenment, now you're realizing that those are just more anchors for your boat. And that's why that one of Ajahn Chah's favorite teachings, which I usually say at every retreat at the beginning, which I teach, we're here not to attain anything, but to let go of as much as possible. That's a part of meditation. That's what Ajahn Chah used to teach. Meditation is to let go, not to attain. And there's, you know, when you read sutras like this and understand, you say, yeah, okay, I can understand what he's talking about now. Not to empower the will, but to let it go. And yeah, there's still some retreats where you are asked and encouraged to strengthen your will. You know, sit and don't move. You know, make your will very strong, so it's stronger than pain. You're tired, get up anyway. You know, just use your will. And you know, those types of meditation techniques cause a lot of problems to people. And you know, you see what Ajahn Chah said, no. Just let go of the will. Okay, I'm going to will myself to let go. You see, that's not it. To let go of the will is just not buy into it and let the will subside. It's called letting go. And when it does happen, then all these things happen. Yeah, go on. Yeah. Very good. Yeah. Exactly. So you think you should prepare for death because you're getting old now. You've got something on your arm there, so it's a sign that you're wearing out. So this is the case that, you know, that we think we should prepare for death. And usually, you know, we use tricks to teach people how to let go. No, if you want to, the best way of learning how to die is learning how to live. Just to be here. In other words, stop worrying about it. Stop thinking about it. Stop, let's say, trying to plan your death or to improve your will. So just, this is all you've got right now. This is your death right now. It won't be any different than this. Maybe the same sort of type of TV program. Slightly different characters, slightly different scenario, but just the same sort of stuff as you're experiencing right now. So it's true, we learn how to let things be. Anyway, seeing thus, the instructing noble disciples experience revulsion towards body, towards this vedana, towards perception, towards volitional formations, even towards consciousness. An experience revulsionate becomes dispassionate. I really argued against this word. It's not dispassionate, the revulsion has already happened. The word is this word in Pali called viraga. You're experiencing fading away. Everybody knows that that word has two possible meanings. Too often they call it dispassion, but really the meaning is fading away, which means these things start to fade away. The body, rather its importance to you, starts to fade away. The thoughts fade away. Your consciousness starts to vanish. Your will fades. Yes. Sorry? Indifference is not enough for it to fade away. Indifference is a sort of uncaring. We say, just, this is not my friend, this is my enemy. Naturally, just the things disappear, they fade. Yeah? Just goes. A good example which a lot of people just say is, you know, when you know, you play with toys as a kid. And you play with toys as a kid. You know, there's not one day you say, ugh, I hate toys. I'm not going to play with them ever again. It's just they're not important to you anymore. And there's the toys, they get stored away in the cupboard and mother just puts them off to some charity, they vanish. Yeah. Yeah. If it faded away, there was some sort of sense of, you know, the revulsion towards it, just basically you turn away from it. And it's not a negative thing, that's... Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it just fades, you see, this is not interesting anymore, it's not important, it's not me, not mine, not self, not my business. So it fades. And that's I like the word fading, because again, it's not a moment you say, right, I'm not going to listen to my music anymore. It's you probably just, you know, you turn it on, you just forget to turn it on anymore, it's not important to you. So this idea, not dispassionate, but the fading, this whole process, once you see what's really happening there, you know, you see it's not me, not mine, it's suffering, you move away from it. I mean, it's the same with when experiencing revulsion, it fades away. And through the fading away, there is a liberation. It's not there anymore. You're liberated from music. You can hear it if you like, but you don't have to, you know, keep hearing it. You don't have to keep checking the news. You don't have to keep having sex. You don't keep having to go to the pub. You don't keep having to, you know, watch the football. And it's okay, but you don't. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Go. 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 Okay. So when the mind is liberated, there comes the knowledge it is liberated. And this is a sequence repeated hundreds of times by the Buddha. And it also answers the question, if you're enlightened, can you be enlightened and not know it? You know, that you're enlightened but you haven't realized you're enlightened. And sometimes people say that, but the Buddha actually contradicts that here very clearly. When the mind is liberated, there always comes the knowledge it's liberated. You understand, destroyed is birth. There's going to be no more birth anymore, no more of these five khandhas anymore, no more body, no more feelings, no more perceptions, no more will, no more consciousnesses anymore. Yeah, but for a lot of people say, hang on, Ajahn Brahm, you mean to say there's nothing left? I can't have a tiny bit of consciousness left, just a tiny bit, just a little bit so I can enjoy my enlightenment and live happily ever after. And everyone is saying no. And it's incredible just how people would wriggle and squirm on that one point. And this is where they have the idea of like a cosmic consciousness, a ground of all being. It says, what I call the ultimate retirement home of the spiritual path. You know, we can live happily ever after. And it says, no. It's all, there's no birth. Nothing, gone. Whole life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being. It's gone. And in other words, the whole purpose of existence has been fulfilled. The path has reached its end. Remember that little box which I've had two of these boxes, they've both been auctioned off. It's my meaning of life box. You know, it's this little box there, and you turn the switch, and then a little hand comes out and turns it off. And that's my meaning of life box. It's just so profound. Is that it? Yes. It's also really funny because that's not what I expect. Sure, it must be more profound than that. Why? Anyway, this is what the Blessed One said. Elated, those monks delighted in the Blessed One's statement. And while that discourse was being spoken, the minds of those monks of the group of five were liberated from these outflowings by non-clinging. They were arahats, fully enlightened. Because that sutta created the first arahats, fully enlightened beings, after the Buddha. That's why this is one of my favorite suttas. And to let you into a secret, I told the monks a secret. When I did my 6-month silent retreat, you know, just by myself, that's my sutta. That's what I just did all the time. Just one teaching for 6 months in silence. And that was, wow, that was best. So that's why I shared it with you today, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the sutta which made the first enlightened beings after the Buddha. Any questions about that? Yeah, at the back, yeah. Yeah, okay. Okay.
Does that mean?
Yeah. Oh. Good.
Does that mean no more feelings, no more suffering?
Yeah. No more feeling, no more suffering.
But are we here to love, to feel on earth? But I know.
Who told you that?
Nobody. I mean,
yeah,
but the society, the parents, the culture, the perception.
Yeah. People say that. That's why we're conditioned. And you'll find in your life, peace, excuse me, but you know, if you think that the only thing to do is to love, you get a lot of suffering. And never any contentment, never any real fulfillment. Because love is impermanent. It doesn't last, unfortunately. You know, you may love a person all their life and in the end they die on you or you die. Even this emotion of love, it's a perception, it's a thought. That too comes and goes. I don't know about your parents, but many people say their parents, when they were young, they couldn't stop looking at each other, always speaking kindly to each other. Now they just tolerate each other. Some other couples are much better than that, but it doesn't last. The idea of you falling in love, finding a partner in life, you know, your husband, you said you were married, you're not always going to feel like this to your husband or to your partner. Your emotions change. Yeah, it's one of the highest emotions. If you get into meditation, there's much better things than love. Wow. What, you mean there's more?
Yeah. I think I've been fooled, been treated all this time, all this life. Been told to love primarily, then I'm suffering primarily.
Yeah, this exactly. It reminds me of one of the similes of the Buddha. He said there was a blind man in the village and this merchant came in selling cloths, you know, like fabrics to the villagers, because, you know, you sell your own clothes in those days. And he saw this blind man there, so, you know, he had this old piece of rag. And so he said, "This is some of the best fabric in my whole collection. And I haven't sold this to the other villagers, and it's just an ordinary rag." And because the blind man couldn't see it, he said, "Ah, wow, yeah, I'll take that." And so he wore his ordinary rag, having paid a lot of money for it from this con man of a merchant. He sold all the other people nice stuff, but, you know, why not? This guy can't see. And then a couple of days later, some doctor came to the village and said, "I can cure your blindness," and he did. And as soon as he cured the blindness, this blind man now could see. What? I thought this was a really beautiful piece of cloth and it's just an already old rag. He would be upset and disgusted, just like you just expressed. I've been taught that this is the meaning of life and now my eyes have been opened. Wow. You get a bit upset, you've been sold a dud. But don't just believe me, as I said to you earlier on. Check it out. Bring your brain into the temple. Don't leave it outside. Otherwise, you know, can you trust that I'm not selling an old ordinary rag? That's why we teach it from the text. This is a Buddha's teachings. Check it out. And you'll find there's much higher pleasures than love. Beautiful stillness and peace. That's much higher. The less you have, the more happiness and freedom. Love binds you. It doesn't free you. Yes? Oh yes, love is a wonderful thing to do, but it is like the people in prison. And they've been born in prison, lived all their life in prison. They don't realize there's anything other than prison. And it's a really nice people in prison. They go around, they get married to another prisoner in jail. And they're very good, they have a lovely family in jail, they've got schools in prisons and universities in prisons, and you can go out to barbecues in prisons, and they have football matches in prisons, and people get very excited when their team in a big prison called Human World sort of wins. And they go around helping each other, just anyone who's sick in their prison cells, they go and make them a bit happier, and they decorate each other's cells and make it very nice, they look after one another, it's wonderful. But they're still in prison. Yeah, because you're on your way out. Hey, at last, they're on your way out. Jeez. It's just whenever you're in prison and you get your parole, wow, I'm leaving soon. Of course you're happy. But also, you tell other people, look, guys, you're in jail. Get out. Because you know the paroles are for free. Just apply, you get it straight away. Attachment is a form of letting go. You're free. The prison, the gates of the prison are always open. These people don't want to get out because all they ever know is prison. Just like the prisoner who's been in jail for years and years and years and years. They get their parole, they don't want to go. They're used to prison. That's why it's very frightening to let go. It's frightening. You're leaving a prison. And you've got used to your prison. Yeah, it's a bit of suffering and pain, but you know, it's got some pleasures in there as well. You know, sometimes Australia does win the soccer. Most of the time they lose. But you know, sometimes they win. Whey! Now you've had your happiness, now you've got to suffer for the next, I don't know how many years. Yeah, go on.
Okay, I would like to address between love, suffering, and pure love or unconditional love. Willing we get out of suffering, like what the senses, we eye, ear, touch, whatever, when we hear and we bring to our consciousness, mind or whatever. So willing to free, let's say, if you love someone, this is mine, he belongs to me, this and that, of course, human suffering. But without all that, like when you give love and kindness, that basic of love and kindness, okay? If you can do that, there is no suffering. Because when you give love to someone, you don't expect anything return. When you not expect anything return, you free will give. And doesn't hurt you, doesn't sad or anything, just, you know what I mean? Uh-huh. Some people, oh, I give, I'm happy. Happy also suffering. Unhappy also suffering, but very hard for me to explain. But if you non-attachment and then, you know, very hard to say in the word.
Yeah.
I hope you understand what I explained, yeah? If human without love, how can we be love and kindness? If you without love, I kill you, I hit you, the dog, the cat, the children, this is all chaos. If without love, okay, this is love. This love is not suffering. This love is unconditioned love. Each one of us must have and contain in our him. I hope it makes sense, sorry.
Okay. But you also have to have wisdom as well. Love without wisdom. Because sometimes, you know, people do some of the very bad things out of love. So when we have wisdom, we realize the best thing we can do is free each other. We have to know what freedom is, first of all. And if you heard me say before, the two freedoms in the world, the freedom of desire and the freedom from desire, the freedom of will and the freedom from will. If you understand the difference between those two types of freedoms, and you really care about others and yourself, give yourself the highest freedom. Teach people how to be free. When you've become free, teach people how to escape from jail. Okay, so I think that's enough. It's almost 4:30. So, sadhu. Sadhu, Sadhu. Very good. Okay, so let's pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha now.